From WJCT in Jacksonville, this is a special edition of Redux. I'm your host, Vince Kong, and on this episode, we'll be bringing you stories from inside Hurricane Matthew. It's Monday, October 10th. Our regular scheduled show for Friday was postponed due to Hurricane Matthew. The storm, blamed for at least 11 deaths in the southeast, forced the evacuation of the WJCT building. From there, we had to broadcast remotely from the Emergency Operations Center in downtown Jacksonville. But more on all that later. On this episode, we'll give you a behind-the-scenes look at storm coverage during a hurricane. We'll also take a look at others who were working during the storm, the destruction the storm caused, and the rebuilding process. But first, an update. Northeast Florida Public Utilities are in the process of assessing and correcting damage to the region's infrastructure after Hurricane Matthew. In addition to lingering power outages and debris-covered roads, officials are also now dealing with millions of gallons of toxic sewage spills. WJCT's Ryan Bank has a story.
A steady stream of rainwater was spilling into a storm drain on Flagler College's St. Augustine campus the day after Matthew brushed the first coast. Massive flooding in downtown St. Augustine and other areas caused sewers to overflow. St. John's County Utilities Tony Cubbage says at this point, he doesn't know how much.
We were inundated with, in some areas, 6 to 8 feet of storm surge. And we have had incidents of sanitary sewer overflows where they're backing up. We're still working in the field right now to document those and to get all the power restored to lift stations.
Lift stations are stormwater pumps used to send extra water to higher ground. Until power is restored, he says it's hard to know just how many areas sewage flowed where it's not supposed to.
I know there was about 24 spots that I've seen so far.
In Jacksonville, JEH says more than 6 million gallons of sewage and stormwater overflowed in 6 parts of the city. The area hit worst was a surface water spill of close to 3 million gallons in the Ortega River. In accordance with a new rule set up by Governor Rick Scott after 2 large spills near Tampa Bay, JEA sent out a notice to the state within a day of the overflow. Last month, a survey released by Climate Central warned spills like this would become more common as storms intensify due to climate change. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
Despite a mandatory evacuation, WJCT listeners never missed a beat when it came to Hurricane Matthew coverage. Here's news director Jessica Palumbo and reporter Lindsay Kilbride bringing you behind the scenes.
We never anticipated actually having to evacuate WJCT. So our plan was to continue broadcasting from our building. But as you know, our building is located basically on the banks of the St. John's River. It's in a low-lying area in downtown Jacksonville.
They were worried about the storm surge. We're right on the river.
It happens to be an evacuation zone B, which was one of the first zones. A and B were the first two zones Mayor Curry mandatorily evacuated. We were going to stay here until he then made a mandatory evacuation for Zone C. At that point, our manager said it was not worth risking the lives of our staff to remain in the building. So we came up with a backup plan.
We were able to broadcast away from the station at the Emergency Operations Center downtown, which is a very safe building.
And we had never run our broadcast operation from a remote site for any extended period of time. We were able to rig up basically what was a remote control of our radio board. So physically, we have a board in studio, which we use to switch. And we had a team of people go to the Emergency Operations Center in downtown Jacksonville.
It's the home base for all the people who are dealing with emergencies, you know, so we have the National Weather Service there, the fire department, you know, the mayor, everyone's sort of there who's making these decisions in the city about what people need to know and what the plan is. And that, you know, it's a several story building, but on the ground floor, that's kind of the media area
where they were able to switch between talking live on air and going to our weather information coming out of Florida Public Radio Emergency Network in Gainesville.
So we're in the media room. That's where we had to sleep that night. We had sleeping bags. That's where the mayor will brief media, and we were operating from there, broadcasting from there too. We had a whole setup.
Our plan was working perfectly until about 4 o'clock in the morning on Friday. So Thursday going into Friday.
Everything kind of failed. We lost our internet connection. And what we found out is our high-speed internet provider, they're also based in Florida, and they were evacuated. So we couldn't get a hold of them. So we had to quickly make a plan.
And that plan was to use primarily the broadcast that was coming out of our partner, WUFT, out of Gainesville. That's where the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is located, and meteorologist Jeff Huffman.
They were amazing. And so basically we just coordinated with them.
Our listeners were able to get up-to-the-minute information about what was going on in Jacksonville.
They were kind of broadcasting for them and us, and what we were doing was
our reporters were still calling in WUFT with live reports and sending in produced pieces that, like Ryan Bank, for example, sent in a piece that he did in Springfield.
Everything that could have possibly happened, and we still dealt with it, and we still got our listeners everything they needed.
And it actually, in some ways, ended up being more robust coverage, I think, because our reporters happened to be in non-evacuation zone houses dispersed throughout the listening area. So from Friday through Saturday, we had reports from St. Augustine, from Middleburg, from Arlington. One lesson is that
our public broadcasting family in Florida is amazing, and we're all going to have each other's backs.
But aside from WJCT staff, myself included, who decided to work through the storm, Ryan Bank reports on one diner that vowed to stay open and did, cooking hot meals for those in need.
A few people were sipping coffee and enjoying breakfast at the Alco Halfway House and Roadhouse Restaurant at about 9 Friday morning. Executive Director Chris Hayes says if the walls in this 49-year-old place could talk, they'd have a lot to say about resilience.
We're the last place in the city where you can actually come in with no money. In other words, if you went down to detox and you found yourself down on your luck, you could come in here, and we serve 3,600 meals a month here. No charge is attached to that.
Hayes says Alco helps people turn their lives around, and in that way, he says staying open for people seeking refuge from Matthew is part of his DNA. Motioning to the boarded-up windows and steel door, Hayes extends an invitation.
If somebody needs a cup of coffee, come on in, and we'll have a cup of coffee with you.
Matthew's expected to be just off the coast of Jacksonville's beaches starting this afternoon. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
By now, most Jacksonville residents have seen the footage of waves crashing against Jacksonville Beach Pier. But while the damage done to County Dock is much smaller in scope, its impact is just as great. I'm here with First Coast Connect producer Kevin Merchart, and we're going to talk about County Dock. Kevin, how are you, first off?
I'm fine. I managed myself to had no problems with the storm.
Excellent. And as far as County Dock, first off, just to put in historical perspective, why is this dock important?
This dock was built in the 1870s by Major William Webb, who owned the land there, and it's been there for a long time. It's very popular in the Mandarin area for people just maybe go out and have a seat to look at the river, watch the occasional manatee and dolphin that go by. Also, a lot of people like to fish off that dock. It's one of the few places where you can hand place boats. Many people like their kayaks and such shoot off from there. From what I talked to, some of the people in the Mandarin area are just absolutely devastated what happened to this poor dock.
Yeah, describe the scene. What did you see out there?
What I saw was, first, you couldn't get very close. Thankfully, that some of the people ran into, I guess, were fans of ours, so they were able to bring us out there. What it has is, about halfway through, the dock is missing. It's underwater. Lots of debris around the area. And basically, they're going to have to rebuild the entire thing. It's just absolutely devastated.
And the story that you wrote was actually one of our most popular stories. Mm-hmm. So it was about 130 shares on Facebook. Describe a little bit the connection this doc has with kind of the community of Mandarin.
It's one thing what they like about that is it's basically their doc. And it's one of the very few that jettison out into the St. John's River. Now, it's a very historical area. Mandarin's very historical. The people who live there take a great deal of pride in the history of Mandarin. That's why they have all these big, beautiful trees. That's why they were hit so hard with this storm, because so many trees went landing on wires. I mean, it's amazing how many people, the memories they shared of being there. We had a woman who told us that she got married just a couple of months ago on that dock. They're really, really upset that this happened. And now they're all seem to be very determined to make sure that this dock gets rebuilt.
Yeah. And just elaborate on that point. What is the future of the county dock?
I have not been able to talk to anyone with the city on this. We tried to communicate with them. However, governor was there. The mayor was visited. City Councilman Schellenberg, who represents that area, all came and visited the dock and see the damage and destruction. So it's fairly apparent that they do want to get this thing rebuilt. As I said, it's only one of the few that jettisons out into the river in the entire city of Jacksonville. So it's a very important place for these people.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
And finally, a story about recovery as the First Coast continues to rebuild after Hurricane Matthew. At the airing of this podcast, there are still roughly 80,000 people without power. Ryan Bank caught up with shopkeepers and landlords in St. Augustine as they assess the damage the morning after the storm.
Dave Border is sweeping away palm fronds, dirt, and tree branches from the front of his World of Flags and Sports shop on St. George Street. Sweat beading on his forehead, he gestures to residue on his shop walls that historic flooding left behind.
At about a foot of water in, you can see the high water mark. I know it's radio. It's about a foot up off the ground, and of course that all went in.
Oh wow.
Despite the sandbags and the boarding.
Border says his store opened 35 years ago. In that time, no storm has caused this much damage. His carpet is destroyed, a lot of merchandise is ruined, and the floorboards on his front stoop are warped. Further up the street, Terry Akris and her husband are surveying retail space they lease. So far, it seems they were luckier than Border. But her home is another matter. Videos on her phone show their Anastasia Island house completely enveloped by marsh water.
There's our backyard I just showed you with all the beautiful grass. This is our porch. This is the little thing for coming into the house. And at this moment, the water was coming into my house. 3 inches of water throughout the whole entire house.
St. Augustine City Administrator Michael Wanchick says as much as billions of dollars in damage is expected. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
And that's our show. You can find all of our audio and web stories at wjctnews.org. You can also stream this podcast as well as all of our on-air content on the WJCT app, which is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. And of course, find us on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe.